yo, what is a cipher?
To me, the fascinating stuff is the arduous years of discipline that it takes to become a J. Cole or a Kendrick Lamar.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This is episode 148, a talk with Idris Goodwin. Idris is an award-winning playwright, poet, rapper, essayist, and spoken word artist. His plays have been put on all over the country, and he has performed on HBO, the Discovery Channel, and even Sesame Street. His book of poems and essays, These Are the Breaks, was published in 2011. Idris's most recent project has been a series of what he's calling breakbeat plays, works of theater that are influenced by and reflect both the content and the form of hip-hop music and culture. His latest breakbeat play, The Realness, is currently running at the Merrimack Repertory Theater in Lowell, Massachusetts through April 10th. We caught up with a Colorado-based Idris at Crosstown Studios in Harlem while he was on a recent trip to New York City. The best way to make sure that you hear each episode of The Cipher as soon as it drops is to subscribe to The Cipher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating or a review. Once you do that, make sure to listen to our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with breakbeat poets Kevin Koval and Nate Marshall on episode 137. But the best way to help the show is to become a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. If you're curious about any of the songs or clips we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's the second Cipher guest to appear on Sesame Street, Idris Goodwin. Might as well ask you on mic now. What are you doing in New York?
Okay, so I'm here in New York working on, was the beginning of a project I'm working on with New York University's graduate acting program. Mm-hmm. And so they hire a playwright every year to create a play for their students. But the process is kind of interesting because I don't just show up with a play I've already written. I work in collaboration with the actors and my director, Jenny Koons. We just start with a topic. And then for 2 weeks, we're going to hang out and sort of traverse New York and boil it down. And then I'm going to go away and write the play. And so the topic that we have, we're just starting with the fact that Jay-Z's album, The Blueprint, dropped the same day, you know, dropped on September 11th.
Right.
Bootleggers bombing Bin Laden. I'm still cracking. I will not lose. I simply refuse. I dropped the same date as the Twin Towers. I show power. Still, I show compassion for others and money and flowers.
And what, and just kind of exploring what does that mean? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because that album's like the beginning of sort of the new Jay-Z, the Jay-Z we know now. Like it's all about empire building. And so what does it mean, you know, for this New York artist to build an empire as, you know, a symbol of empire is coming down? You know
right.
what I mean? And that album's got so many allusions to war in it. There's so, the word war shows up so many times, right? So on Takeover, he says, hey, little soldier, you ain't ready for war.
Hey, little soldier, you ain't ready for war. ROC too strong for y'all. It's like bringing a knife to a gunfight, pin to a test.
And then on that song, Jigga, Jigga, that nigga, Jigga. You know, he says, and if y'all want to go to war with me, I'm going to go to war with y'all.
Right.
And if y'all got love for me, I got love for y'all.
Jigga, Jigga, that nigga, Jigga.
And if y'all go to war for me, I go to war with y'all.
You know, so there's all of that kind of language like in there. So we're just kind of starting from there. We're going to go to a Yankee game. We're going to go to Marcy. We're going to go to the Bronx. It's going to be lovely.
That's awesome. Yeah, I remember like I was living in Boston when that record came out. I remember, I don't know if I, if I went to buy it that day or the next day, something very close, you couldn't pay with a card because the systems were still down from the attack. Like, it was just such a bizarre sort of juxtaposition.
Did you write a check, Sean?
I may have floated a check that never, I was just out of college. So it was like, you know, they, you know, I may still owe Newbery Comics $15.99. Sorry, guys.
Where'd you go to college?
Berkeley.
Oh, Berkeley School of Music?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you play?
Bass and guitar.
That's right.
Yeah.
You're a musician as well. So Sean, when did it start for you?
Well, it's funny you should ask. But yeah, like that Jay-Z moment, and you said also like the beef with Nas, which obviously had been simmering since, you know, 1996 or whatever, that it came out at that moment, it became like a public thing, was notable and sort of plays into this whole thing as well.
The Jay-Z Nas beef has been traced as far back as Nas allegedly not showing up to a Jay studio session back when Reasonable Doubt was being recorded. It first became public knowledge in June of 2001 at Hot 97 Summer Jam concert, when Jay ended his now famous diss of Prodigy with these words. That warning shot would expand into an entire verse on Takeover when The Blueprint came out that September.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's like Nas up to that point. I mean, there was that adage, right? Like, who's the best MC, Jay-Z, Biggie, or Nas,
right?
You know?
Couldn't talk about it if you ain't living. I'm from where niggas pull your car and argue all day about who's the best MCs, Biggie, Jay-Z, and Nas. With the drugs
and Big was gone. So there was really just those two, and it had been coming for a long time. And so, yeah, beef. I mean, we're also looking at this idea of beef. You know, what does beef mean? So, like, you know, Mos Def has that line on his song Beef, where he's like, you know, beef is not what Jay-Z said to Nas. Beef is when the working people can't find jobs, right?
Listen, beef is not what Jay said to Nas. Beef is when the working folks can't find jobs. So they trying to find niggas to rob, trying to find bigger guns for them to finish the job. Beef is when the crack babies can't find moms, cause they end up on a box, a lot behind bars. Beef is the summer jam for Hot 97. Beef is the cocaine that AIDS epidemic.
So we're kind of looking at that, like, fabricated beef, internal beef, global beef, you know. And yeah, so it's gonna be really interesting. And I was listening to the album again this morning, and just it's awesome. I mean, it's also like a really amazing album. And I remember at the time I was like kind of sometimey about Jay-Z, and I actually didn't buy that album. What made me go back and get that album was the Unplugged album that he did with The Roots, the MTV one.
I don't want much, yo. I drove every car.
And then that made me like go back and like pick the actual like album up, you know. But yeah, I'm really excited to dig into it. I mean, a lot of my work is about hip hop, you know, and being a fan of hip hop, participating in hip hop, but also just really digesting and really unpacking like all of the nuances and details. And just trying to be like, what do these things mean?
You said something about hip hop lyrics one time, and I'm paraphrasing now, but the idea is like pop lyric writing, R&B lyric writing is supposed to be universal, right? You hear a song about like, oh, I'm so sad because she left me, and like you get it immediately.
Right.
Whereas hip hop lyric writing is meant to be, you know, specific and local and like dense and elusive. And you said something about how that's sort of supposed to keep everyone from understanding hip hop in a way. It's supposed to kind of keep it from being universally accepted. But it is in a way. And so I guess I wanted to kind of ask, you know, kind of start there. It's structured in a way meant to keep people out. But yeah, is it really keeping people out?
I don't necessarily think the idea of hip hop lyrics and lyricism is to keep people out. I actually think it's to bring people in, come into my world, come into my universe. Like, this is how we do it over here.
Right.
You know? And so, yeah. So the pop idiom is like, how can I like scrape and boil away any of the specificity of this not only so it's quote unquote universal, but I believe the universal is actually in the specific. It's why we love movies, you know, and why we can see ourselves in, you know, an animated rat or whatever, like, you know, it's because of the specifics of that. But pop is like, you know, it's disposable. And so it's not specific. It's not subversive. And so hip hop, by its very nature of people saying like, yo, like we're over here and, you know, you want to forget about us, but we're here and we're alive. And not only that, like we're fresh and awesome and like you're boring and tired, is actually quite subversive. So even just a song that folk might think is trivial or whatever is actually like quite subversive to even say your name on a track or say or rename yourself to say my name is not what's on my birth certificate. My name is actually like, you know, Dougie Fresh. You know, my name is not Douglas. My name is Dougie Fresh, actually. You know,
I guess like to bring it back to Jay for one second, one of the things that he's so great at is having a song that can have this kind of universal appeal and sneaking in, you know, these very, very hyper specific things. I think of the line on Click, mm-hmm. right? Whereas, you know, the Dream Team meets the Supreme Team and all our eyes green. Mm. It's like you wouldn't know that, like, you know, what percentage of the people listening to this song know who Ken McGriff is,
uh-huh.
know that he had green eyes, and kind of get the illusions.
Who we gonna tell? We top of the totem pole. It's the Dream Team, meets the Supreme Team, and all our eyes green, it only means one thing. You ain't fucking...
Kenneth Supreme McGriff is a convicted drug trafficker whose 1980s crack distribution organization in Jamaica, Queens was called the Supreme Team. He famously has green eyes. He was arrested in 1987, released in 1994, and was eventually convicted of murder for hire in 2007. He is now serving a life sentence. You can read all about McGriff and his music business connections with Murder, Inc. and 50 Cent in Ethan Brown's superb 2010 book, Queens Reign Supreme, Fat Cat, 50 Cent, and the Rise of the Hip-Hop Hustler.
So I think it's like, I guess, you know, how much does something like that matter? That, like, there are, you know, layers to this, and, like, some of the audience gets... you know, this part and some of the audience doesn't and things like that.
I think it just makes it last longer too, because mm-hmm. there's still things that I listen, you know, the album that I've probably listened to the most times in my entire life is Big Daddy Kane's Long Live the Kane.
Mm-hmm.
And I am like, still, I'm back. Like, I still hear something. I'm like, oh yeah, I get that now. You know, whereas when I was like 11, I was like, I don't know what Asiatic means, but it sounds good.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And so your playwriting, like, you know, obviously we had Kevin Koval and Nate Marshall on, and they talked about, you know, breakbeat poetry, what being a breakbeat poet is. What is breakbeat plays? What is being a breakbeat playwright? How is that related?
So the whole, like, breakbeat thing, first of all, shout out to Kevin Koval and Nate Marshall. Those are the homies. So the whole breakbeat thing came up just because, you know, I think every generation of artists wants to define themselves in some way. We all want to push up against... you know, what came before us, or be like, carve out our little space, our little niche. And, you know, we were on the phone talking about it. And we were like, we didn't like slam poet. We didn't like performance poet. We didn't like spoken word, you know, all that stuff. And it was like, we grew up on the break beats, right? Like to make it as plain as possible. But we started writing most of, you know, that me and Kevin's generation, you know, we're 70s, you know, Reagan babies. You know, for us, we found our voice and fell in love with language within the confines of the beat. You know, that's where we started writing, within the beats. And so even with the beat taken away, that's just in there all the time. And so I think anything I touch is breakbeat influence. I teach, you know, I'm a breakbeat professor. You know what I mean? Like everything I do is informed by just a rhythmic pattern, you know? And so that's what it was. It just started as a conversation. And then as we got our weight up and people started letting us make books and produce plays and stuff, you know, we started wanting to call ourselves something to set ourselves apart, you know, like this is what we do specifically. But also help create a lane for the people who come after us too, you know? And they'll probably shake that off too and be like, that's tired and we're actually something else, you know, which is cool as well.
Yeah. But so the actual name Breakbeat Poets, that was you, that came from
I did coin that phrase.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. But listen, it's not about me right now. I don't want any credit, you know, whatever. Just,
right,
you know,
right.
Just invite me to the dinner. That's all I ask. I don't need to be at the head of the table. Just, you know, put me somewhere. Put me by the buffet table.
Right.
But a breakbeat play, for me, it's like a form and content thing, right? So they're plays that are, you know, formally influenced by hip hop. So like what from the aesthetics and the toolbox of hip hop, you know, around lyricism, around crowd interaction, around the integration of music and reference and layering and all of this. You know, how can I use that within this Western dramatic format, right? The play, right? Or what we most people consider a play, a drama, right? How do I work that in there in a way where folk aren't like, oh, this is like some other thing, where they're like, oh, these are characters, this is a drama, right? But then in terms of content, I'm also interested just in like the way that, you know, what's America been like post-hip-hop? Like, how has hip-hop affected and changed America in a more, I think, in a more nuanced way? So not, the plays aren't really, most of them, sort of like these large, sweeping, grand statements on, you know, the industry of hip hop. They're really just about people, you know, who have a certain relationship to this culture. And so a lot of the plays are very like sort of working class. They're very like everyday folk, you know what I mean? So I'm trying to like take something familiar and do it in an unfamiliar way.
Yeah. And speaking of that kind of like grassroots working class thing, so many of the plays focus on, you know, the grassroots side of hip hop. It's not taking place at, you know, award shows and arenas. Right. It's like ciphers inside of, you know, small, you know, spaces that aren't clubs. That's or, you know, at high school lunchrooms or whatever, things like that. Why the focus on that side of the culture? Why is that important? Like stuff that, you know, people who aren't necessarily into hip hop might not even necessarily be aware that it exists or might not have thought about.
I think it's just that, though. I think it's that most people don't see that part of it. People see the end result. They see the product. You know, most people engage with like hip hop cultural product, but they don't. But to me, the fascinating stuff is the arduous years of discipline that it takes to become a J. Cole or a Kendrick Lamar. I mean, one of the reasons that Kendrick Lamar is like one of my favorite MCs right now is, it's just the level of work that I know it takes. You know what I mean?
I've heard some of his early stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like early.
Right. When
you
he know. Was K-Dot, right?
Yeah.
Whoever thought young Kendrick was spit so ignorant? Make street disciples go and get a membership. A street's revival like Creflo Dollar hustling on the strip. This is church. Advise you to purchase it or copy the worst. Y'all rhyme sloppy.
I mean, the rigor, like, you know, I just know, I don't know, it's something about just like, oh man, like I'm enjoying this, but like in my mind, I'm just thinking about like, man, how many hours did this guy put in? Yeah. So like, you know, and so that's kind of what I want people to see. And also like, just that it's culture, that it's organic and intuitive and, you know, there's a whole other side to it, a whole world of it that's really like, you know, earnest and optimistic and kind of foolish, right? Like we were, you know, Scribble, you know, look at Scribble Jam that used to happen in Cincinnati, Ohio. The play, The Realness that I have going up this month out in Lowell at Lowell, Massachusetts at Merrimack Rep.
And ends there, that Scribble Jam, right?
Well, it's not called Scribble Jam, but it's basically Scribble Jam. Like it's basically Scribble Jam. But like, you know, something like a Scribble Jam is this sort of thing that starts in Cincinnati, Ohio, you know, by just, you know, some kids who wanted to make something dope happen. And it brought like hip hoppers from all over the region to like engage in these battles and everything like that. And it's like, that's such a, you know, you can just imagine all of them caravanning out there to Cincinnati, Ohio, thinking they're going to get signed or think, you know, but at the end of the day, just like, I'm going to get some big ass t-shirts and, you know, go see some great battles and smoke a lot of herb and, you know what I mean? I'm really drawn to those kind of stories in that world. And that's also a world I know. You know what I mean? I grew up in and outside of Detroit, Michigan, lived in Chicago for a super long time, and then have been living in odd, random-ass towns like Iowa City, Iowa, and Colorado Springs, Colorado, and Albuquerque, New Mexico. Shout out all those places. And they all have scenes. You know, they all have their little, you know, their small but very dedicated scenes. And, like, there's some dope people in them. You know what I mean? And so it's, again, like kind of shattering this notion that, you know, the mythology of this, you know, that an MC is only one thing, you know, or comes from one place. And it's like, this is everywhere, you know, and there are people grinding. And this is how it started. Like, you know, the original sort of, you know, that original generation of hip hoppers were just folk, you know, they were just like people in the neighborhood, you know, all of that, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's that's what I'm interested. That's what I'm drawn to, you know?
Yeah. And you mentioned like the idea of people who aren't aware of that coming to hip hop through mediation, right? Through seeing it on television or mm-hmm. hearing records and kind of getting that side of things. And you said yourself that your initial experience of hip hop when you were a kid was mediated, right? It wasn't like the Park Jam, it was the record or it was Yo MTV Raps mm-hmm. or whatever, that kind of stuff. Why? I mean, but it seems like unless you were from like 1987 onwards or whatever, I think that describes a lot of people's, if Absolutely. Not most people's first interactions that's with right. hip hop. Why is that important?
Well, I think that's what gives the play power. So the play How We Got On, right? Sort of is the play that kind of launched me to a new echelon in the world of theater. I think the reason that that play has gone to so many different cities and has been generally well received in all those cities is because that's actually most people's story of hip hop. It's most people's experience with hip hop is exactly the same as the kids in the play, which is like, you know, they were the one in five hip hop fans in their whole town. You know what I mean? And they had to really, you know, you used to have to fight to be a hip-hop fan, you know what I mean? Like, you used to have to, like, drive long distances and, you know somebody at the record store and tell them to order, you know, because they ain't going to just have OC, right. You know what I mean? They ain't going to have OC times up. Like, you got to order that special. You got to order, you know, you got to order the King Just single. Like, you know what I mean? They're not going to have that. So that's why I think people recognize it, because they're like, you know, if I wrote a play about, you know, someone like we love the Jay-Z story, right? But for the majority of hip hop fans, they don't know that life. You know what I mean? Like, so that's why we like it. That's why we love Jigga, and why we appreciate that story, and why we I think appreciate and begin to see, you know, Black folks in urban areas differently than what the media portrays. But generally speaking, the vast majority. You know, it's middle class. It's a middle class experience. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not a story there. That doesn't mean there's not a there. You know, because I think for a lot of us, particularly myself, to be an African American coming up in, you know, a predominantly white upper class kind of like area, you begin to ask these questions about identity, right? Mm-hmm. And the common route is to go to assimilate. But then you have this music being made by other young people of color who were like, actually, fuck that. I'm not assimilating. You know what I mean? Like, and my sneakers are fly and my haircut is dope. And, you know, here's some jewels. Here's some names and references that they're not teaching you in your white high school. Here's some figures in history that they're not teaching you about, you know. So also like dropping jewels as well. And so that's I think that's very significant, you know, and that's what I wanted to look at, to take it beyond this. I think the initial notion of like, well, you know, this is street music and you're not a street person, so you're just faking the funk. And it's like, well, that actually is disrespectful, I think, to the music and the culture. Like, it actually has real things to say about art, but also how to, you know, how to be in the world, about your awareness.
Yeah. And how we got on, like, sort of the central thing, off-screen thing that kind of moves the characters is Yo MTV Raps.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The seeing it, wanting to emulate it, wanting to see themselves in it.
Yo, you watched Yo MTV Raps last night?
Yeah.
You ever think that should be me on there?
All the time.
Have some truck jewels, tracksuit, fresh kicks, four-finger ring.
What kind of song?
Be some girls, two big earrings.
Like a battle song or like a dance song?
Just chilling. Leaned against the car like, I'm just here, you know?
Yeah. I'm just here. It'd be amazing.
And you set the show in 1988, right? As it was getting on the air. Why was that show crucial to you personally? And then why set the story? Why have that play such a big part in the play?
Yeah, well, I mean, think about it. You know, up to 1988, basically, up to like the point where there is a daily show about, you know, playing hip-hop music, hip-hop videos, the only way you could engage with the culture in any way was like through like Right On magazine or Yo magazine or whatever, or if, you know, trading tapes or whatever. But you didn't really have a lot of images, really. You didn't so the videos provided just a new lens into the culture itself. You know, it was not just disembodied voices or still images. Now, like regularly, you're just seeing the world. You know, the rest of the picture, and it's every day. I mean, it's daily. You know, And also, man, that 88 lineup, dude, I'm sorry. Like,
oh, yeah.
No,
yeah, I was looking at the albums from that yesterday, sort of in preparation for this, and it was just like a never-ending list of...
Oh, it's the best stuff.
Yeah.
Saw the release of now classic albums from a staggering number of artists and groups, including Biz Markie, DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, Boogie Down Productions, EPMD, Big Daddy Kane, Public Enemy, Eric B and Rakim, Salt and Peppa, NWA, Two Live Crew, Eazy-E, Ice-T, MC Light, Ultramagnetic MCs, Slick Rick, Marley Marl, The Jungle Brothers, King T, Stetson Sonic, and more.
88's the year I think hip-hop proved that it can make great albums. I think up to that point, there were great hip-hop songs, there were great hip-hop singles, but this is the year that it's like, actually, we can make literature, like we can make full bodies of work. Yeah.
And how we got on, there's this great moment in it, kind of just in passing, but I thought, especially since you're a professor, I wanted to delve into it for a second, which is, you know, Hank, the kind of main character, his teacher looks at his raps and just goes into this incredibly condescending thing, comparing it to like the great works of literature.
Yeah.
I swear to God, Mrs. Lynam, let me hand in my demo instead of a paper.
I feel the spirit of gospel. D. Powell, it's reminiscent of Leroy Jones. Ooh, such soulful texture. Negro spirituals. James Baldwin, Invisible Man. February, we shall overcome. A minus.
Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah. So, yeah. So I think it's something like, I feel the soul of gospel, you know, Leroy Jones, February or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I think that was just a generation, you know, I think the older generation would do one of two things. They would either be like, this is not music, this is rubbish. Or particularly black folks would be like, oh, this ain't nothing but some, you know, this is just what we used to do in jazz. Like, you know what I mean? Y'all got this from us. You know, this ain't nothing new. So I think, you know, it is like a little bit of a nudge. But there is that. I mean, and it's not wrong. Like, you know, hip hop is in that continuum, right. You know, of black arts movement and, the arts of the African diaspora. But yeah, that moment is just a little kind of nod to that, where it's like it's either just this is garbage, or it's like immediately
genius,
just like, trying to we're just trying to box it in with all black art, you know,
right,
what I mean,
right.
Like yeah
that was a great moment. So that whole play, you know, you talked about being a breakbeat playwright and having hip-hop into the structure of the play. That play is actually kind of conducted, mixed, whatever you want to use the word, by the character of a DJ,
yeah,
who, you know, narrates and actually kind of sometimes manipulates the lines of the characters.
Listeners, tonight I bring you the flip to the A, the B side. I'll be toasting, I'll be selecting the waves, steering the wheel. Welcome, I am Selector. Now, normally my show runs about an hour and a half, but we're gonna keep it under an hour for you all today. So I'll just be playing the essentials. We going back to 88, y'all. Now, this won't be an uptown.
How'd you get the idea to do that in the first place? I don't think.
Oh, yeah. That was an idea I'd actually had for a while. And it was just like, you know, the whole like hip hop theater thing, you know, starts like around the mid 90s, you know, with Danny Hock, who's play Jails, Hospitals, and Hip Hop. I would consider like the Illmatic of the genre.
If I was you, I would just talk to your lawyer, right? And tell him that you want to plead guilty. Because what happens, B, if you plead not guilty, they try to make it a first degree felony against you, and then you have more problems than you had in the first place, especially if you're just an accomplice. I mean, I ain't saying you did nothing. I wasn't there. I just met you yesterday, you know? But I'm saying especially because, you know, because you're black. I mean, are you black? Oh, I thought you might be, whatever. Just trust me. Just plead guilty, 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 whatever. Otherwise, what they do...
And after that moment, this sort of hip-hop theater moment, there was a lot of things that were modeled after mixtapes, right? The idea was like, you know, a mixtape for the stage, a mixtape for this. And what that usually meant was it's usually like one person writing a series of pieces, like spoken word pieces or monologues that are somewhat... you know, we're not following one quote unquote storyline, really. It has an arc thematically, but they would, you, a lot of times, you know, to a lesser degree, folk would just throw the word mixtape in and just kind of put together a bunch of spoken word poems that they've done.
Right.
But I still thought there was something to the idea of a mixtape for the stage. And so I was like, a mixtape for the stage actually would be, you know, how do you blend, how do you actually like do what DJ Clue does, right? You know, stopping a record, starting it again, screaming over it. You know what I mean? There's a way that like mixtape DJ, you know, the mixtape is really the DJ's medium. Like it's really the DJ telling a story through their, right. through the things that they select, you know? So it was just an idea. It was like, how do I blend two scenes together? Or like, how do I, you know, have a character that screams over scenes or whatever, like Clue, you know, new Illuminati or whatever.
You can't catch me unless your bait is strong enough. Them niggas in my comments ain't been.
So, you know, I had it for a few years and then I was actually at the University of Iowa. My wife was getting her MFA there, and there's nothing else to do in Iowa City, Iowa, except go to the University of Iowa. Like literally the first year we were there, I was just like, good, you know, I'll do this, that, and the other thing. And then after a year, I was like, I might as well go get, you know, a MFA. So I was in their playwrights workshop, and my first, you know, semester there, you know, I had to write something. And at that point I kind of turned my back on playwriting because I just got like frustrated. I kind of hit a ceiling. My plays weren't really getting outside of my circle. They weren't really getting outside of Chicago. And so I'm like, I'm going to write something that I know, and I'm going to try to do it in an unfamiliar way. I'm going to try to like, hotten up, you know, just like the familiar.
Yeah.
And so How We Got On came out, and it was like, I just sort of like went to that idea that I'd never explored before with this whole like mixtape idea, and, just kind of jammed it out.
And, you know, your friend Kevin Koval, who we mentioned earlier, has been a guest on the show a couple times.
Yeah.
You did a play with him.
Yeah.
This is Modern Art.
That's right.
About sort of inspired by time the Chicago Museum got people graffitied the outside of it, wrote on the outside of it.
On February 21st, 2010, a 50-foot-long graffiti piece was put on the wall outside of the Art Institute of Chicago's then new Modern Wing. The tagging was bookended with the words Modern Art and Made You Look. The artists, though, captured on security footage, were never caught.
So, you know, Kevin had mentioned the play. I knew a little bit about it. Researching it, I discovered, like, there was this whole sort of controversy, for lack of a better word, around it, where, you know, a few sort of mainstream reviewers took exception to the idea that you guys were glorifying graffiti. I read the reviews and the whole line, like, of all the possible reactions you could imagine someone having to your play, to that play in particular, whether they loved it or hated it, if you thought about, like, oh, I wonder what the reviews are going to be like, was that particular reaction something that ever entered your mind prior to it happening?
I figured that's what we would get.
Like,
I figured that. Because, you know, graffiti art is one of those things that, you know, much like abortion, you know, I'm serious. It's never, people are never going to see eye to eye on that. Like, it's just right down the middle. Mm-hmm. And my opinion, it is always going to be that way. And I will say that even a lot of graffiti writers would rather it remain illegal. For them, that's part of the aesthetic. Part of the aesthetic, you know, is the book called The Art of Getting Over. Like, that's part of the experience of graffiti, is that's dope. You know, just yesterday when I got to town, I'm staying in the East Village. We're pulling off the FDR Drive, and I see a huge piece high up for the graffiti writer Next, right? And I'm like, oh, that's wild. But then the next thing I thought was, man, how'd he get all the way up? How'd they get up there?
Right, that's always a part of the thing.
So yeah. I just knew it was going to be that way. Like, I knew that even though it's a piece of art, even though, you know, we set out to write a play about these people who practice graffiti. Mm-hmm. We weren't writing some propaganda for graffiti. You feel me? It's just a play. It's like if we were writing about, you know, whatever, you know, anything else, it's the same thing. But I knew that the response would either be, you know, good for these guys, you know, or it would be graffiti is not an art. You know what I mean? It was to be expected. I did not expect that the reviewer from the Sun-Times, the Chicago Sun-Times, wrote a review that almost felt like it was like out of the 30s, and it was like, you know, like reefer madness.
Chicago Sun-Times theater critic Hetty Weiss's review, now mysteriously deleted from the Sun-Times website, called graffiti writers urban terrorists and read in part, quote, "This play is wildly wrong-headed and potentially damaging work. One that fails to call vandalism by its name and rationalizes and attempts to justify that vandalism in the most irresponsible ways."
And I was telling Kev, I was like, we were joking that, like, wow, she just made us infamous. She just made us NWA, bitch. She just made us Dre and Easy at this theater game, you know? And, you know, but I think the most exciting thing about the whole thing was that the community had our back.
Right. You know? You had a lot of people rally behind you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was exciting. Just to see that a play and a response to a play could incite folk to start thinking critically around, you know, I don't really care if people, you know, what people think about graffiti or don't think about graffiti. You know, that debate will outlive all of us. But it was dope to see people really be like, no, actually, wait a minute. You know what I mean? That was really inspiring, actually. And I said very little because I didn't need to, like everyone else was saying.
Right. Yeah, so definitely people speaking on your behalf.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
And sort of, I thought, interestingly, pausing the reviews is kind of this form of like soft censorship, right? A warning to the theater, like, you know, if you try stuff like this again, maybe, you know, don't give funding to things along this line.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
This is Modern Art director Lisa Ports was the one who called the reviews soft censorship. She wrote to a reporter, quote, "Reviews like these could certainly hurt a theater financially and discourage taking a similar risk in the future."
It was very dicey, very, 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 but it was fun. It was also a very fun time. And wherever I go, people bring it up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did a reading here of a play called Bars and Measures at the Lark last year in March. And during the Q&A after the reading happened, this woman was like, "Hey, I like this play, but I just wanted to say, like, way to go with that whole 'this is modern art' thing." I was like, that's when I was like, okay, this wasn't just like a Chicago thing. This really resonated outside of the city. So it was very exciting.
Nice. And so one thing that every artistic director of every, you know, theater company in the country talks about is getting young people into the theater. How do we get young people in the theater? This is what we're going to do. We don't want our subscribers to be all, you know, 70-year-old blue-haired ladies or whatever. Right. You've actually had some success with that.
Yeah.
How?
So it's tricky. I think the biggest issue with getting young people to the theater, hands down, is just money. Plays just cost too much money to attend. I saw a play here last time I was in town. The ticket was like $75. You know, which is, and it wasn't like a musical. It was like a drama. It was very good, but it was $75. So that's for one. So as much as folk want to throw salt at the wonderful seniors who are the lifeblood of the theater, it's like they're the only ones who can afford it. So that's one. And yeah, you can do your little student rush or your like discount Tuesdays or whatever, but people ain't got time to be sorting all that out. Like, you know, if the folk got to take an extra step to find out, like, every third Thursday I can come for half price if I bring a brunette with me, like, come on, they're not going to go. They're going to be like, never mind, I'm just going to go to the movies because I know how to do that. So a lot of it is just, like, the practice. Also, like, building the practice of, like, making the theater a regular occurrence. I think for my plays, you know, my plays are just the sort of plays that I think are just inviting to, you know, someone of my age or younger. They're like, oh, I know what that is. This is for me. I would like to think, I don't know, but I would like to think that folk feel a certain amount of agency. I think it's also because it's uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think one of the other things that I would like to see more of is a lot of these theaters, they'll do the one kind of wild card play and then they'll go back to business as usual, right? So they'll do the one wild card, they'll do How We Got On, and then they'll do like, well, they won't do How We Got On, but you know, they don't build on it. So if they do have a success with a play like mine or other plays that are similar, they won't build their whole season around it. So, you know, I've had a lot of success with smaller mid-sized companies that are run by younger folk that understand that they're not just building, they're not just doing one-off plays. They're trying to build seasons. They're trying to build a culture of, you know, these are the kinds of American dramas that we're interested in. So, like, Company One out of Boston is, like, a really great theater where their seasons are, like, consistent. They're really building a whole culture around certain types of work, you know? So I think that's what it is. I think it's also just, you know, our demographic getting more excited about the medium. I mean, and that's part of why I'm here, you know? I mean, I'm a huge fan of the show, but part of why I was like, yo, I need to be on that show is also, it's like, I think folk who love hip hop, you need to be aware that this work is happening. This work is happening in their cities, you know, and check for it in the same way that you check for albums or you check for concerts. Like, or you know, that there's really interesting work being done in other mediums. And that's what me and Kev and Nate and Adam Mansbach, that's what we're trying to do in novels and books, and you know, we're trying to like spread it around a little bit more, that it's more, you know, this point of view and these styles extend beyond just the confines of a rap record.
Yeah. And you know, one of the plays that you wrote that I haven't read, but I am fascinated by and wanted to talk to you about, is you did a play about John Brown and Frederick Douglass.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And their relationship. And I've been, you know, obsessed with John Brown on and off for a very long time.
Yeah, man.
So can you tell me a little bit about that and why you, like, what about their relationship or dialectic or whatever, like, inspired you to write about it?
Yeah, well, let's see, where do I start with this? John Brown. I mean, there's so much to say. I mean, he's just a fascinating figure, for one. I mean, you know, for all intents and purposes, you know, he was a religious fundamentalist terrorist. You
right.
know what I'm saying? Like, you know?
I was
really drawn to, I think people downplay how fervent and violent just the debate and fight over slavery was in this country, like intense, you know, for a super long time.
There was literally a guerrilla war that he was a part of.
Bleeding Kansas, sometimes called Bloody Kansas or the Border War, was a series of violent political confrontations in Kansas and Missouri between 1854 and 1861 over whether Kansas should enter the United States as a slave state or a free state. John Brown and his sons were heavily involved in the conflict, including leading a now infamous attack that killed 5 pro-slavery settlers near Pottawatomie Creek.
Absolutely, yeah. And so that's really fascinating to me, the fact that he was a radical. You know what I mean? He was a subversive radical, but he was right. Like, he was on the right side of things. And there's a theory that, you know, his failed raid on Harper's Ferry was kind of like one of the last straws that led to the Civil War, you know.
I've read that, the idea that the South didn't know if there was one John Brown or 10,000.
Yeah, exactly, right. Yeah. And also, he's keeping in a long line of these, like, you know, insurgents. You know, so you had Denmark Vesey, you had Nat Turner, you know, and he was trying to actively recruit Frederick Douglass. They had like 3 like secret meetings, and I was just fascinated, like, what was said at those meetings? And for me, it's like, there's also this question of privilege. So it's like John Brown's privilege as a white male, I think, allowed him certain access that Frederick Douglass couldn't garner. And I think there...
Like, rich abolitionists who would buy him guns and stuff.
Exactly, yeah. The means, and also just to be able to walk in daylight, you know, do things in light, you know. And for Frederick Douglass, it's like, he's an escaped slave. He's a former slave who escaped. And I think for him, his objective was to live long and to work within the law. And then for Brown, it was just like, nah, son, you know what I mean? I need to bust these guns. And I think that point of view still exists. Amongst, you know, our sort of radical communities today, there are still those who are like, no, let's get, you know, revolution, son, you know. And there are those who are like, no, we're going to get these signatures and we're going to, you know what I mean? Like, you know, so it was kind of all those things were floating through my mind when I wrote the piece.
Sure. You know? And obviously that split happening along racial lines in the struggle for, you know, to end slavery and whatever is also very interesting.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, I read a lot about history. You know, I've written, I have a whole other series of plays that are kind of nonfiction, that are drawn from nonfiction, drawn from real life. Mm-hmm. A lot of plays that explore race and power and all of that. So, yeah, right. One of my other threads.
Including one about Muhammad Ali, which you got to put on in, let's see if I can say it like they say it, Louisville.
Yeah, it was commissioned by a theater company there called Stage One, who they're right next door to the Ali Center, which, by the way, is like one of the coolest museums
ever. It is.
Super dope. And they were partnered up and they were like, yo, like, a lot of people, you know, most of the things that are written about or explored around Muhammad Ali are about, you know, Vietnam on, Sonny Liston on, him changing his name and converting and not going to Vietnam, coming back, Rumble in the Jungle. But few know about his early days, like when he was just a kid, like how he got into boxing, like what was the origin story when he went to the Olympics and all of that. And so they invited me to write a play about those early years, to write Ali Begins is what I called it.
Trained and trained, even sparred with other boxers, but this... my first real fight, it was different, everybody watching.
And it was great. It was a really great experience. I got to meet people who grew up with him. I got to go to his house where he grew up. I went to like you know different neighborhoods, talked to people in Louisville, and the play is very much about that city. And you know, this is also around a time like Emmett Till happened, the beginning of the bus boycotts starting to pop up. You know, it's the kind of we're coming to the end of Jim Crow, and he's this young, you know, very outspoken, you know, black kid, you know, who goes to the Olympics and comes back and still can't eat in certain restaurants, even though he's got a gold medal,
right?
You know, even though he represented the United States of America. Like, so yeah, that was what that play was kind of looking at. And it just went to St. Louis as well, just closed in St. Louis. And I believe it's going to Nashville next.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I mean, and it's insane that, you know, in some ways the conversation hasn't really changed from you know, early 60s or when is that play set?
Basically in like 50s and 60s.
Right.
Yeah. He went to Olympics in 1960.
Yeah.
But it starts like, I think in like 52 when he was like nine. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I feel like not that much is generally known, like you said, about Ali's early life as opposed to afterwards. It's kind of people are like, oh, yeah, he threw his medals in the river, right?
Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
sort of the beginning and end of it.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, but there was a lot too. I mean, you know, the thing that...
That in and of itself may or may not be true, right?
No one absolutely. Really knows. Yeah, I've heard conflicting reports. but I love that. I mean, I love that that's also like one of the great... You know, he's so aware of his own mythology, and he's so aware of his narrative and what his narrative could do and how it can be used. But I think the thing that I didn't even realize when I was writing it, and I think now has even more resonance, is the fact that the person that first introduced him to boxing was a white police officer. Somebody stole his bicycle and he was freaking out because it was brand new and he was 12 years old. He ran up to this police officer named Joe Martin, was like, hey, like somebody stole my bike, and he was all worked up. And he's like, man, when you find who took my bike, I'm a whoop him. I'm a kick his ass, you know? And the cop said, well, do you even know how to fight? And he was like, yo, if you want to really learn how to fight, come to this gym where all the other cops work out at, and we'll teach you how to box. He brought all these different kids from the neighborhood into this policeman's athletic club to learn to box. And that's been the thing when we were in St. Louis, which is Ferguson is part of St. Louis. A lot of kids saw the show. And that was the thing that surprised them the most. And we asked them afterwards, like, what did you think was going to happen when Cassius goes up to this police officer? And a lot of them were like, oh, we thought he was going to get arrested. You know, we thought he was going to get hurt some way. You know, we didn't expect this police officer. So it was something I just didn't realize. It was just a fact. It was like, okay, this is the guy, you know, who brought him in.
Right. You didn't put it right that way to make a point.
Right. Not at the time. Because at the time I wrote it, Mike Brown hadn't happened yet. Trayvon had happened, but the Mike Browns and the Sandra Blands and all that had yet to occur. And so now looking at that moment in this new context has been really fascinating and I think really eye-opening. And it poses the question too of like, what made Joe Martin different? Like what are the police not doing that Joe Martin was doing, you know?
And so any discussion of hip hop and theater, you know, should include at least a little bit Broadway. You wrote an essay, you know, we had this whole kind of 3-episode arc on Holler If You Hear Me.
Right.
You wrote an essay thinking about maybe why it didn't succeed, speculating on some of the reasons and, you know, going on some of the stuff you'd heard about it and whatever.
Yeah.
I was just interested in your thoughts about how that fared as opposed to how Hamilton is faring. And if you have any thoughts about the contrast in reception there.
Yeah. Well, you know, I also have not seen Hamilton.
No one has seen Hamilton.
Yeah, exactly.
When we had Saul on, Saul Williams, who, you know, we asked him about this as well. He obviously had his own ideas.
So I haven't seen either show, and this is just from an outsider perspective. And shout out my man, David Diggs, who's in Hamilton. I think he plays Rapid Jefferson. I think one of the biggest factors I would say is that the Holler If You Hear Me musical is a jukebox musical.
Right.
And that's a very different kind of animal. I think it's a bit riskier because it's like, here's something built around Tupac's music that isn't about Tupac. So already it sets up an expectation of, well, what they going to do? How this going to be? You know, people are sitting there trying to figure out the connections and whatever. So it's a harder sell in some ways. You would think it'd be an easier sell, but it's actually a harder sell. I think with Hamilton, you know, you've got Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote In the Heights and was very successful. I mean, he clearly knows what he's doing. And so it's in Hamilton, although it's based on, you know, real figures, historical figures. It's an original, you know, for all intents and purposes, it's an original story. It's an original musical that he sort of tailored. And so I think that, you know, just from the outsider perspective, that's probably the biggest difference. But, you know, arts, you know, theater especially, is, you know, it's collaborative, and sometimes things just don't gel. You know what I mean? Sometimes things just don't come together and just don't work. You know, like that time LL Cool J did that song with that country artist.
If you don't judge my do-rag, I won't judge your red flag.
Trying to understand what it's like not to be. I'm proud of where
if you don't
I'm
judge
from,
my gold chain,
but not everything we've done.
I'll forget the iron chain.
It ain't like you and me can rewrite history.
Can't rewrite history, baby.
Sometimes things don't just, you know.
Come on, that was great. That was a classic. That was a classic moment.
That set us all back. That set race relations back. I love LL Cool J, but that set us back.
Yeah, that was rough for everyone involved, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have your book, These Are the Breaks.
Yeah.
It's came out 4 or 5 years ago. Fantastic book. And it's so unusual because it's like I wouldn't even necessarily know what to call the pieces. Yeah. In it, because it's this mix of essay and memoir and poetry kind of all mixed up. And I think the percentage of each kind of differs from piece to piece or whatever. How would you describe the book?
Oh, man. I call them poetic essays or performance essays. It originally started with, you know, I've done breakbeat poetry for a long time. And I got to a point where I was interested in just sort of a broader palette, so to speak, or a broader canvas, you know, as far as what I wanted to explore or talk about. And so I started writing these things that took on more essayistic type forms. Also, at the time, my wife was getting her degree in nonfiction writing, and lyric essays were like, that term lyric essays was being thrown around a lot. And so I think that was sort of in the ephemera as well. And so it just started with like a few pieces that I wrote that were longer for radio, actually. I was working with the NPR affiliate there in Iowa City. And so that's where it started. And I was just like, I should do more and more and more. And then the publisher, Write Bloody Books, was like, yo, these are fresh. Like, can you write more of these? Can you put together a manuscript? And so that's how that happened. But I would say that they're like, you know, sort of, you know, we'll call them breakbeat essays, maybe.
Yeah. And one of my favorite ones is you write about being a kid and being in a car going to Detroit and listening to Isham and having Isham kind of be like the sound of the crack era.
Yes.
That's which, you know, people might think is sort of odd. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Oh, man. So, yeah, man, Isham is, you know, a Detroit rapper. He was probably, to my knowledge, the first, you know, rapper to kind of co-opt that sort of hard rock, heavy metal, you know, devil worship kind of motif.
See, I've been to hell and back, and that's a fact. I get a flashback, one day I'm a snap. My mind is gone, pinch is on. I wish the whole world would just leave me alone. I want to die, I do not die. I'm on the far side and it's passed me by.
And so for a lot of, you know, black kids, you know, who are coming from these very strong Baptist households, like it's one thing to talk about like busting guns and hanging out on the corner. It's another thing to talk about worshiping the devil. And, you know, it was called acid rap. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
So it also sounds like that, you know, and there was, you know, and there was a lot of stories around, you know, there was a lot of mythology around, like, who is Isham? Oh, you know, so all these stories would be like, oh, he's down with this particular gang, or like, he's a one-man gang, gangs are scared of him, you know. and that was Detroit in the 80s, man. Like, that's when we left the city because, you know, our house kept getting robbed, and it was just starting to get a little scary. And we were in a nice area, Detroit, you know, it was a nice residential area. We had a great, you know, sort of childhood there, but towards the mid to late 80s, man, it started getting kind of dark. And for some reason, like in the movie in my head, Isham is playing over the opening credits, you know?
Amazing. And another essay in there that I loved was the one about Prince B, about the KRS-One PM Dawn situation, which, you know, we've had on the show people who were there that night and heard their memories of it and whatever.
For more on the infamous KRS-One PM Dawn incident, see episode 117 with KDEF, who gives a first-hand account of the night. And stay tuned to the end of this episode after the credits to hear Idris read this essay in its entirety.
What inspired you to write about that essay from the point of view of probably, you know, who is the person who is in public memory the biggest loser of that situation?
I think that's definitely like sort of my theater influence there, my playwriting influence of, you know, the job I think of a playwright is to kind of be aware of everyone's possible point of view in a moment. And in a play, I always tell my students this, in a play, everybody thinks that they're right. So I wanted to, I mean, we've all heard that story. I remember reading the Source magazine. That's also what I loved about that. That's so different about, you know, hip hop in the 80s and 90s is like you got news from the Source. That was it. Like now it's like, you know, Drake getting busted in the head with a champagne bottle or whatever. Like you hear about that 10 minutes after it happened. Like it just happened and somebody's got a video of it. And like this KRS-One, Prince Beasley, it's such an amazing story. But it's mythology. Like there was no video of it. Like we'll never know exactly what happened. And so for me, it was just like kind of a moment that was ripe for drama, you know?
Yeah.
But I just thought I'd put a different spin on it. You know, what was that guy thinking in that moment? Yeah. You know?
Yeah. And that book begins with a preface, a piece called A Preface, which is about like definitions of race.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole point of it is you sort of like bring up a possible definition of Black or Latino and then problematize it so that it kind of gets fucked up and goes away.
Yeah.
And then try again and miss again and try again and miss again.
Yeah.
Black means you're not white. And if you're not a nationality, then you're Black, which means brown, but not Latino. Though it should be noted that plenty of Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, et cetera, and so forth, refer to themselves as brown, unless, of course, you know, they come from Spain. Now, if they come from Spain, brown means gypsy. Now, when I say Black, surely you would think that I'm including those individuals from places like Trinidad, Jamaica, Barbados, et cetera, and so forth. I do, in terms of race. They are Black. Except, of course, for the non-brown people that live in those countries.
What inspired that piece?
I don't even know, man, to be honest with you. Like, it just kind of flowed out, you know. And, you know, absurdity is definitely in language and definitions and race as a construct. All of that is always swirling around my head. So, yeah, it just kind of like, I write pieces like that every day. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's light work. But, yeah, it was also just one of those things that I could, like, kind of hear it as I was writing. I was like, this is going to perform well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I performed it pretty regularly for a while.
Your own writing, like, you started out doing stuff for movies, right? Screenwriting.
Well, no, I mean, that was what you studied.
I went to film
school as an undergrad, and, you know, I thought that's what I wanted to do, mainly because, you know, there were just no, you know, all this stuff. You know, Nate Marshall came up in the sort of youth poetry slam world of Chicago. And, you know, that world that I worked with Kevin, you know, the Louder Than a Bomb and Young Chicago Authors, all of that. Part of what inspired me so much about that is like, I was like, man, I wish I would have had this. And that's part of why I wanted to contribute to that. But I didn't have that. So, and you couldn't go study hip hop in college. So for me, it was like film is the next best thing because it is, there's a collaborative element to it. And so that's what I went after, but then fell in love with theater because of the live aspect of it, you know, and that's the thing I think of about hip hop that I like the most is that it's live and it is, and like you can do whatever in the studio, but like, can you rock a show? Can you, you know, if an MC says something to you, can you say something back? You know what I mean? Yeah. That's going to be dope and like on point. You know, B-boy, you know, there's an expression by the artist Mark Bamuthi Joseph. This is, if you don't commit to the head spin, you'll break your neck. And so, like, hip hop as this thing that you have to be very trained in, you have to be very focused to do right. You only get one chance to do it right. And so I was very drawn to that in theater because it's the same way. It's like you get the one shot. You got to work your ass off and rehearse forever so you can do it one time perfectly, right. You know.
Yeah. But when you got into theater, it was at the Art Institute of Chicago. Right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Which was pretty experimental crowds. It seems like an odd thing to like get into a new art form sort of at the fringes right off the bat.
Well, I think I was really lucky in that way because I was mad young when I went to graduate school, probably younger than I should have been the first time I went to graduate school. And it's just because I just didn't know what I was scared of the world. You know, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I needed more time to find my voice and build my toolbox. I knew how to like cut film and splice stuff together and work cameras, but I didn't have any, I didn't know what I wanted to say. And the Art Institute, because they were so experimental and their writing program was very experimental, it was very wide open. And there was one playwright on faculty there named Bo O'Reilly, who has, you know, his very own, you know, small punk rock kind of theater company called the Curious Theater Branch, invited me in. He was just like, write a play, you know, and I know you don't know what you're doing, but here's a room and go for it, you know? And, you know, incidentally, that play, it was called Brazing. It opened on September 5th, and the second performance was September 11th, and we had to cancel the show. And, yeah, anyway, that was a weird memory. I don't know why I just remember that.
Yeah.
Just it was good for me, and it just gave me some time and space to just fail a lot and learn. And so then when I went to graduate school a second time at the University of Iowa, many years later, I was able to knock out a play like How We Got On, because at that point the thing I needed was access, connections, resources, and the big university provided that because it brought in guests, and it was sort of tapped, you know, connected to the industry in a way that the Art Institute wasn't. And truth told, when I was there, I was not ready for the big stage, so to speak. Yeah.
And what were the best moments for you during your time working at the Jenny Jones Show?
It was when the Cash Money Millionaires were in my green room. I worked in the green rooms, and the Cash Money Millionaires were there. It was all of them. It was like Wayne, Baby, the whole lot. And they were just fascinating to watch. Also, AG. Mm-hmm. Of showing AG when he was doing albums with Party Artie. You remember Party?
Yeah,
the late
yeah.
Party Artie?
Yeah.
D Flow. God Bless the Dead. Yeah, and D Flow. They were also in my green room, which was great. And AG was surprised that I knew who he was.
Wow.
I remember that. I was like, yo, man, like, I'm a big fan. You know, I grew up on your music. That song, The Party Anthem, is like one of my favorite songs of all. That song still goes, by the way. Like, next time you're in the car. Next time you're in a car, put that Party Anthem on, man, and just crank it. It goes. It'll save your day. So I told him that, and he was like, really, he was just really surprised by that. So that was a great moment too.
Nice. What were some of the, were there any like wilder, more stereotypically the like Jenny Jones?
Oh yeah. I mean, it was a horrible job, dude. It was terrible. Shots fired. Yeah. Shots intentionally fired. It was awful job.
Yeah. How do you wrangle whose job it is to be out of control?
Yeah, usually insane. I mean, it was exactly what you think it would be. I mean, like, usually in my green room, it was like, and there's the porn star, and there's the crazy grandma, and there's the, you know, teen runaway, and there's the, it was insane. In the audience, they would cart these audiences in and, like, rile them up, and, like, you know, they had this, like, crazy warm-up comedian who would, like, bring people, they would, you know, it was very orchestrated. They knew exactly what they were doing. Wow. It was crazy, man. I was sitting there like, what am I doing here?
I think one of the things so many people wonder about daytime TV is like, these people can't possibly be real. Did you get a sense of them were actors or?
No, they're real. They're real. At least for that show, they were.
Wow.
It's just, it's what it is, man, is it's you take people out of their normal environment and then you keep them there a long time and you just sort of give them new rules and you encourage them to misbehave, basically, to act crazy, to act irrational. You got the people who work for the show encouraging that. And so it's brilliant. It's almost brilliant how they do it. But that's, you know, it would start very early and just over time gradually, and they keep you there, and next thing you know, you're like wiling out. But yeah, I mean, that and the expectation of the guests is, I'm gonna go on here and wild out and show my ass,
right?
You know, incidentally, Springer was right next, was in the same building, was like right next door to us too, and the Springer audiences and the Jenny Jones audiences were pretty much identical. I think just everybody showed up and they were just like, okay, it's like when you're in school and they're like, okay, let's count off 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And then, like, you know, one group would go to Judge Joe Brown, another group would go to Springer, another group would go to Jenny Jones.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's a dark time, Sean.
Yeah. Sorry to bring up, you know, the harsh past there. I want to talk about The Realness for 1 minute.
Yeah, let's go.
Because I love the play and like,
thank you.
The idea of what's real, you talked about this at the beginning of like someone trying to negotiate, in this case, the character from kind of like a middle class, upper class background being fascinated with what he initially thinks is like real, you know, real hip hop, real life in the city and all this kind of stuff and how that mutates over time. Can you just sort of talk about this idea of real a little bit and what it is and how it shifts in the play?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the play is really just kind of looking at the difference between culture and cultural product, you know, so... You know, if a kid walks, you know, if a kid walks out of his house one day and he's rocking his hat a little differently and, you know, he's putting certain colors together, someone from, and someone from the outside walks by him and is like, ooh, that's interesting. I'm going to find a way to make money off of that exact look. Right. That person from the outside can go and build a whole industry and put their kids through college selling that kid's innovation, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But by the time it reaches the masses, that kid will have already adopted a completely new and different style. And so I was just kind of interested in that split of like, by the time someone from the outside consumes a product, the actual, it's already kind of played out a little bit, you know, and things in hip hop move so fast and so swift on a cultural level. The terminology changes every day. The dances change every day. The styles change every day. And the marketing machine, the corporate machine has to try to keep up with that, you know? And so I wanted to write about someone who identified with the product and thought that identifying with the product gave them entree or gave them a pass into the world that it came from. And setting it in the context of a love story. I also wanted to just write a love story. Because in relationships, I mean, that question of, are you real? Like, do you really know me? Are you really down for me, like the crust of me? You know, that question comes up as well. So yeah, that's what the play is looking at in the most broadest strokes. But it's really just, it's also just a sort of a young man's journey. Like, we do a lot of coming of age stories about people when they're little kids or you know, people home from college and figure out what they're going to do next. But I want to do something about that age where you've just left home. You're still not quite an adult, but you're not a kid either. You don't have any money. You have no cultural wealth or agency. You really don't know anything, but you know enough to not be living in your mama's house, you know? That's what it's looking at. And also there's a lot of, you know, it's underscored by beats. Like, the beats are underneath everything, underneath the monologues, underneath the scenes. I also wanted to do sort of an ode to Lauryn Hill. There's a character named Prima who's kind of loosely based on her and Angie Martinez. So I also wanted to write a very powerful female MC as well. And she's dope. You know, the actor playing her in the world premiere, Dio Nunez, is very dope. The whole cast is dope. I'm very excited. I'm going back to Massachusetts.
I would say that premieres this spring.
Yeah, it premieres March 16th. March 16th, it drops. Merrimack Rep all day. And then from there, who knows? You know, who knows? Hopefully it'll have the same kind of life that Howie Got On had and be around everywhere.
Nice. And so in addition to all this writing, you are also a rapper.
That's right.
Got a couple records out.
Spit these bars.
Yeah.
Too blessed to be stressed. Enjoyed far too much success to ever even be vexed. And yet, temperatures rising at the sight of this mess. And yes, we progress by only inches and steps. But still, they bent and lost to keep the people in check. The screen project picks up the brutal hands that's gripped round the neck. No.
How is writing raps different from, like, poetry, from essays, from plays, the other stuff you do? When you sit down to write, are you like, okay, today I'm writing a rap and it's going to be in this format? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it started with raps for me. Like, Big Daddy Kane, Long Live the Kane. There was nothing. I had no choice. You know what I mean? Like, that album was so seminal. It's like a part of my DNA. You know what I mean? And I wanted to be Kane.
We actually just talked to Fonte Coleman. He said the same thing about that record.
That's right.
Yeah.
Fonte's dope. Yeah. Shout out Fonte Coleman. I it started there for me, you know, and from there, Brent, you know, that's the root. So that's just my practice. Like, it's beyond like even something I ever wanted to, and this is not to say that I never wanted to like be a quote unquote professional rapper, whatever that means, but I am a rapper. Like, that's just part of me as a human being. Like, and so that's just practice. So I do it all the time. I'm always writing rhymes in my head or on my phone or whatever, loose bars. I don't really write songs as much anymore just because these plays are taking up my time and my three-year-old's taking up my time, you know. But I just write these bars like all the time, all the time. I just wrote something new the other day called Black Garrison Keillor. Because I've been doing, I'm one of the contributors to this show that we have out in Colorado on the NPR affiliate there, KRCC. We do a show called Critical Karaoke, myself and two other professors. You know, so doing that show, we, you know, when we're off air, we joke. I do this thing where I like pretend to be Garrison Keillor, but like the Black Garrison Keillor. So I wrote some bars called Black Garrison Keillor.
Oh my God. Would you care to share them with us?
You want to hear these?
Yeah, let's see.
I see. How does it start? Rapper Americanus, Aphrodonus non gratis, persona letter maker, writer over the breaker, funk, soul, rock, whatever get chopped, huckster or the tightrope walker, quite dope talker under the big top with a scientific interest in syntax, semantics or the grammatical possibilities of the sick raps. Product of the 80s, product of the racial mountains, moved by the family who made me. Echo of the greats, echo of the grands, echo of the dark melanin stitched inside of both hands. Slave to the roots, slave to my rhythm, slave to no man. Break chains with the mic I'm here gripping. Button up your lippin', the ship is here sinking. A product of the political plans pushed by Abe Lincoln. No shrivel, no shrinking. Stand with my chest out, run my mouth a minute, telling stories of those left out. Stack rap lyrical dealer. I'm the Black Garrison Keillor. To everybody who had enough on the front lines, I feel you, for realer. And then it goes on from there, but yeah.
Excellent. So finally, what else? You have the play opening imminently,
yeah.
The Realness in Merrimack.
Yep.
What else is going on?
Isn't that enough, Sean? No.
You're the guy who worked on 5 plays in 5 weeks. Don't tell me about it.
Yeah, I'm out in these streets.
Too much.
So. All right. So the Realness is happening. This is Modern Art is going to New Haven, Connecticut, to a theater out there. I'm working on a play called We Want the Funk for the University of California Santa Barbara's theater program, actually. That's a play set in like 71, 72. And it's really kind of exploring like Afrofuturism and P-Funk and this idea of like Black folks looking up to the heavens looking up to the cosmos for an answer, for an alternate reality. Basically, it's like the 70s, you know, post sort of Motown, post civil rights era turmoil. Mm-hmm. Black folks started like taking LSD and playing electric guitar more, like
right.
shredding on the guitar. It became
right.
less about singing and more about instrumentation and transcendence. And so it's set in this like factory community in a city like Detroit. Workers get laid off, and there's this one worker who's like convinced that if he unites the workers to become a band, like this sort of like ragtag band, that they can actually like transcend their existence. It's a good show. Wow. It's a fun show. So working on that, I'm collaborating with this artist from Scotland on an adaptation of Frankenstein. I guess it's like the 200-300 year anniversary of the writing of that book. We're doing a project with the Kennedy Center, adapting Frankenstein. So working on that, working on a piece for Oregon Shakespeare Festival, it's another historical piece sort of in the John Brown lane, but it's about the survey groups that the Department of War sent out to the West to explore the possibilities of a transcontinental railroad. This was right before the Civil War happened. And, you know, yet to be fully colonized by the U.S., stolen by the U.S. And so there were these groups of soldiers, scientists, geologists that were just kind of out in this wilderness, like, you know, taking pictures, but sketching plants and all this kind of stuff and
yeah.
talking to different indigenous tribes. And so it's a play kind of looking at that. Geez, what else? I think that's it.
That sounds like enough.
You know, and just the other plays are still going. Oh, my play! I got a play called Bars and Measures, which is a play about brotherhood, faith, and incarceration and jazz. That play premiered last August at Sacramento at a theater called B Street. It's experiencing what we call a rolling world premiere, where it hits, you know, one after the other, three different cities. So it's going to, in the summer, it'll be at Prop Theater in Chicago. Then in the fall, it's going to Jungle Theater in Minneapolis and the Boston Court Theater in Pasadena, California. I don't know why it's called Boston Court if it's in Pasadena, California, but I always have to say that. So yeah, I'm out here, man. I'm out here, man.
Amazing. Well, thank you, Idris Goodwin. I got how to pronounce your name from the piece you did about it.
That's right.
How do you say it? I call myself Idris.
Idris.
That's how my mama says it. But she's probably not saying it right.
Thanks. Yeah, yeah. It's a fantastic piece.
Thank you,
thank you for coming through.
Oh, it's my great honor, man. Thank you.
Theater is an art form that, when you mix it with hip-hop, can often produce confusing or watered-down results. But Idris's plays are something else entirely. As you heard in the interview, they take not only the language, but the social situations and even the musical forms of hip-hop and put them on stage in new and creative ways. It's work that takes these kinds of chances, that innovates in these ways, that is going to keep theater alive for future generations. I'm glad that I was able to talk to someone in the trenches of this fight and to share that conversation with you. Also, honestly, any excuse to talk about John Brown is just fine with me. I was lucky enough to be able to read The Realness before this interview, and I loved it. I strongly encourage our listeners who are in or near Massachusetts to go see it at the Merrimack Rep. Join us next week when our guest will be the rapper Kambada. I found out about Kambada originally through our episode 82 guest, Nino Bless, who was raving about him. I quickly found out why. Kambada's incredible writing skills and far out but captivating concepts won me over immediately, and I'm super excited to share him and his music with you. We're also going to have a contest where we give away a t-shirt and the coolest business card you've ever seen as a part of this episode. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating and a review. And don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow if you enjoy the program, and help us out with $1 a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. Better yet, tweet at the artists you want to see and tell them to come on the show. More information about anything related to this podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
Somebody stole his bicycle and he was freaking out because it was brand new.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Also like dropping jewels as well.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
You know, I write pieces like that every day.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
That set us all back.
Our intern is Aziza Hassan.
70-year-old blue-haired lady.
Special thanks to our top Patreon supporter, Vikram.
And I think he plays Rapid Jefferson.
And now, Idris Goodwin.
Fallen off. My name is Atrell, but they call me Prince B. I'm a vocalist, a poet, not a rapper. My brother, DJ Minute Mix, and I make up the group PM Dawn. We're just a couple of brothers from Jersey. Our stepfather, he's a musician too. Played with Kool and the Gang. You might have heard our brand of hip-hop inspired easy listening, maybe on your drive home from work. We sample a lot of British soft rock. Our single, Set Adrift on Memory's Bliss, might remind you of Spanadu Ballet's True. At least, that's what we'd hoped. We're a far cry from the tough guy. I guess you could say we've crossed sonic borders. Those hardcore hip-hop heads call us soft, say we're not real, question our sexuality. But me? I think that every guy has something feminine in us, and vice versa. That's just the way it is. I wonder if rock bands go through such hazing. I imagine they can select their volume without threat. Case in point, I was just about to lay my oars in the waters of Memory's Bliss when we were rushed by a hip-hop icon, a figurehead, leading a crew of guys too built to be in the music industry. One fist stole my microphone, another threw me from the stage, punched me off the stage at my own concert. I haven't hit the ground yet. This guy, he's considered a teacher. That's what this is all about, some statements I made in an interview. I called his music sadistic, said, rappers who are black trying to prove manhood make things worse, make mountains out of molehills, say nothing at all. But the teacher was most offended when I questioned what it is he taught. He'll try to justify his hypocrisy, stating, I'm a teacher of respect. This act of aggression from the same man who masterminded the Stop the Violence records will set a precedent for copycats. His music is deafened by rage. And the so-called teacher will spend many years trying to stop the reverberation. Maybe my fans will catch me, hold me up, carry me gently back to the stage, embodying the peace and love and unity and fun crap that they peddle. Maybe they'll denounce the fraud on stage, the teacher demanding that they jump. But impact approaches. I can almost taste the sticky rum and coke floor. I don't know where my brother is, maybe hiding under his turntable, maybe wrapped around it. The teacher, he just cut off our beat. Spanner du ballet hasn't been heard since. Music groups die quicker than sound waves. Ex-fans let me fall, face first into obscurity. Maybe you'll dig me out of a record bin, resurrect me for reality television, prop me up to audition for my own reenactment.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Listen, we're getting too real. See, I just talking about the police. Talking about the police, and then suddenly, I guess it shut it down, Goodwin.